tune in to Turn On the News daily from 313.9.org. You can go to newsroom.313.9.org for links to anything you might hear here, including links to international radio art, radio news, media news, links, and more. Go to 313.9 and newsroom.313.9.org for everything you want to know about transmission arts. And to hear Turn On the News daily. You're listening to Turn On the News, a radio show about radio. And we're first going tonight to Free Speech Radio News, which has a report interviewing Eva Galperin, the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator, Electronic Frontier Foundation, about the situation in Syria, how the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and rebels have killed more than 100 government soldiers since last Friday, and violence continues in Syria as government agencies are fighting back increasingly on the internet.
Today, United Nations officials say that Syrian authorities have agreed to allow some humanitarian access to four areas in the country. Those include Daraa, Deir al-Zor, Homs, and Idlib, where government forces have for months launched bombardments and attacks on civilian neighborhoods. Activists with the local coordination committees report more than 40 people were killed in government strikes on Monday. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said rebels killed more than 100 government soldiers since last Friday. As violence continues on the streets in Syria, attacks are also taking place online, as both government agencies and activists turn increasingly to the internet. For more, we're joined by Eva Galperin. She's the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's been monitoring cyber tactics in Syria. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi there.
You reported on the increasing number of cyber attacks on activists within Syria, including Trojan spyware that comes via Skype. How does this work?
We've actually been seeing attacks from pro-Syrian government hackers that specifically target activists and opposition members in Syria since approximately January. And we've seen two classes of attack. The first is usually a very typical phishing attack, where you are sent to a website that looks exactly like Facebook or looks exactly like YouTube, encouraged to log in, and then the attackers gather up your login credentials, which gives them access to your private and personal information. And the other is the Trojan attack, which usually include some sort of Trojan spyware, which covertly installs itself on your machine. Usually it logs all of your keystrokes, it collects all of your passwords, it takes periodic screenshots, and then it sends all of that information back to an IP address in Syrian IP space. Most of the Trojan attacks that we have seen all send the information back to the same IP address, which indicates to us that it is all the same person or group of people.
That IP address where this information is going, is it known who's the owner of that or where it's located?
That's actually something that's very hard to establish.
Mm-hmm. You said you've been monitoring these attacks since January. Has there been an increase in the number of attacks? Has there been a pattern of how they're developing?
They've certainly been increasing in frequency and in variety, especially as the Syrian government has become more and more concerned about people who are contacting members of the mainstream press outside of Syria and telling people about what's going on. Those people are definitely being targeted.
Can you talk more about the pro-Assad computer activists who are behind some of these attacks, or what's known about them?
Well, what's interesting about them is really how much is not known. There are at least two groups which are engaged in sort of in targeting of opposition activists in support of the Assad regime. At least one of them is the Syrian Electronic Army, which is not officially affiliated with the Assad regime, but certainly very supportive of it. And as recently as a few months ago, Assad gave a speech in which he publicly acknowledged the Syrian Electronic Army, and the other is this group which is behind the malware attacks, which does not have a name, and again is not specifically supported by the Assad regime, but it's certainly gathering information that would only be useful to the Assad regime and are targeting enemies of the regime very specifically.
Is it known how successful these attacks have been, how much information has been gathered, or how disruptive it has been to activist networks?
Well, we do know that activists have been infected with the Dark Comet remote access tool, which is a Trojan which gives the attacker full access to the person's computer, and that information has been sent back to this IP in Syrian IP space, which we find extremely troubling. We do know that that activists have been rounded up. They have been detained. They've been jailed, and occasionally we do know that it is as a result of intelligence that the Assad regime has from their computers, and we find that deeply troubling.
Eva Galperin is the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She joined us to talk about threats to online freedom and expression in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
I'm Tom Rowan. You're listening to Turn on the News, a radio show about radio. And today we're looking at television, and specifically the Video Freaks Collective, VIDEOFREEX Freaks, a countercultural video collective from 1969 to 1978, first based in Manhattan and then later based in Lanesville, New York, and Greene County, New York, upstate in the Catskills. Founded by David Court, Curtis Ratcliffe, and Perry Teasdale. And now filmmaker John Nealon is putting together a documentary about the influential video freaks who started the what they claim is the first pirate television station in the country in Lanesville, New York, and Greene County in the early 70s. They have all kinds of video footage from Abbie Hoffman to the Black Panthers, and Lanesville, New York residents in the early 70s as well, who participated in what became a sort of community television station and later a model for public television's open access. So first we'll hear a bit of a trailer for the Video Freaks documentary, and then an interview with John Nealon about his documentary about the Video Freaks Collective.
There was too much going on. We found it difficult to work.
And we started looking for a place where we could all live together to save money.
At first, we were looked on with a little bit of suspicion. You know, the hippies from New York, they're weird, they're going to have, like, orgies, they're going to make all of our children drug addicts.
People hadn't been doing this before because it was illegal.
Lanesville TV is back on the air.
For us, it was a chance to play and to experiment.
Here we are, back behind the Lanesville TV news buggy.
It built trust. There was a lot of bonding.
Hi, Mark.
Howdy. How are you, Pigs?
Good, good, good.
Did you give birth this year?
No, we got all small.
No. It was wonderful because it hadn't been done before. It was, like, so exciting.
The second piece of Lanesville news is Frankie Benjamin's accident.
So if anybody has any messages, they should call us up at 7084. Birthdays, special announcements, any lost dogs. We were living for the moment. We weren't thinking about selling anything at all, except selling the notion that the sky's the limit in terms of experiment and change and making the world into a better place.
Uh, Now with me via Skype is filmmaker John Nealon, who is doing a putting together a video documentary about video freaks and up on Kickstarter, has a Kickstarter campaign to raise the money to put out, get the film together. And why don't I let John, I'm sure you can do a much better job describing the process. John, are you there?
Sure. Yeah, I'm here. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, we're doing a Kickstarter campaign to help raise funds to finish a film that we're producing about the Video Freaks. The Video Freaks were a collective, a video collective. They were together from 1969 till about 1977.
A large part
of their story, main part of their story, takes place in the Catskills. They originally came together doing a pilot television program for CBS. They were tasked with getting into the counterculture at the time. This is 1969, and the mainstream media was not really covering it in the best way. So they found some people who were not in the mainstream media. A bunch of young people who were using Portapak portable video cameras, which was a new thing at the time, actually, brand new technology that the television networks were not using at all. Kind of revolutionary in many ways. And the Video Freaks came together to, you know, working for CBS. They created a pilot, which CBS did not pick up, a little too progressive in many ways. And yet they stayed together as a collective, making videos, documenting the movements at the time. We're talking about the height of the anti-war movement and feminist movements and Black Power movements, and the Video Freaks were right in the center of it. And the way that story comes to the Catskills was that after a while of living in New York in Soho in the middle of the chaos, they left the city as a large group, and they all came up. There were about 10 in the group at the time, and they moved to Lanesville, as I'm sure you know where that is. And they rented a large, like a rooming house, and they set up shop in Lanesville.
And is here where they claim to have set up the country's first pirate TV station?
Yep. And what happened was they lived there for a little while, and they just as a progression of their own art, moved into the broadcasting, and they set up a pirate television station. With a transmitter and with, you know, equipment that you can't really go to the store and buy equipment that will let you start your own television station, especially not in 1971, 1972. So they were really on the vanguard of technology, and they had a piece of equipment that was actually purchased with money given to them by Abby Hoffman, originally with the intent of creating some sort of disruptive broadcasts down in the city, but they changed its purpose and created Lanesville TV. At the time, Lanesville could, you know, it's in a valley, couldn't really pick up any television stations, yet everybody had a TV in their house with, you know, candles on top or whatever. But what the Video Freaks did was they brought local, homegrown television to this small town. It was actually quite revolutionary, and it worked. There, people were picking it up on their broadcast. You know, Channel 3 Lanesville.
Do you know what the community reaction was like? Or did they start participating in the televisions?
Yeah, the community was I think at first, from my interviews with the Video Freaks members, at first they were not really accepted necessarily. It's a very tiny town. Here come, you know, 10 long hairs from the city, up in the rooming house, and I don't think they were at first embraced. Yet, once the TV station started, and once they really connected with these people, and that's really what happened, they really connected with the townspeople. They were quite accepted, and the people of Lanesville became the talent and the audience, cooking shows and fishing shows and one famous show about a local fight, you know, like a fundraising boxing match, and kids shows, all kinds of things by starring and for the local people of Lanesville. It's quite amazing, actually.
And this pirate TV station in the Catskills became the model for the public access television. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say. It's a predecessor. Basically, what happened was it was really a model for low power television stations. What they were doing was illegal. It was against FCC regulations, but it wasn't immoral by any means. It was revolutionary. So what ended up happening was, in some ways, it served as a model to some FCC regulations that came along not soon after for setting up low-power television stations, just like Lanesville TV, all over the country. And then basically what happened historically is cable happened. And in many ways, these low-power television stations were the predecessor to public access, which, love it or hate it, it's pretty revolutionary concept in and of itself. And that is that people should be able to control what they see to a certain extent. And when a cable company comes to town, they have to give access to, local media. And whether that's, people doing their own thing or whether it's just town meetings and things like that, you're not going to see that on NBC, put it to you that way. It's revolutionary in its own way. And Lanesville TV was the forerunner to all of that.
And we're talking to John Nealon, a filmmaker who's making a video documentary about the Video Freaks, a Catskills-based pirate television collective from the early 70s. And John, I guess you've been going through a lot of old tape?
Yep. I first learned about the story. I had a film that was part of the Woodstock Film Festival, and I showed it at a screening in Saugerties, actually, one night, and I was approached by a friendly audience member who turned out to be one of the Video Freaks, Bart Friedman. He's a filmmaker, video maker who lives in Saugerties. And he told me and my wife and filmmaking partner the story of the Video Freaks, how they came together as part of CBS and how they were in the middle of it all and started the TV station. And it seemed like too great a tale not to be a part of. And so not soon after that, we started to look at some of their tapes. And we're kind of blown away, actually. There's an immediacy to this footage that is unexpected. You see a lot of footage from the late 60s on, Woodstock and all those things. But it has a very distanced feel, and you start watching some of these tapes that the Video Freaks make, and it feels like you've just gone on a time machine and woken up in 1969. There's just a real immediacy to it all. It's hard to really explain unless you see it. And we were captured by it. The other part of the story is that around the same time, it was being the tapes were being kind of collected up, and it was revealed that a lot of these tapes had been sitting around in various Video Freaks attics and basements for all that time. And unfortunately, there's a lot of degradation that happened to these tapes. And that's a part of the restoring these tapes is a priority for the Video Freaks and for us as filmmakers and for Video Data Bank, which is an organization in Chicago that's helping facilitate the restoration of the archive. There's hundreds of tapes. And they just have little labels on them that say, could say anything, because you can't, it's not like film. You can't hold it up to the light and see what it looks like. It's videotape. And so you got to go by what was written on the outside of the box, which isn't always accurate, and nor is it comprehensive. So it's pretty interesting as these tapes get restored to see what's actually there.
And I guess restoring the tapes is part of the Kickstarter campaign. We should probably give that information out. Where can people go if they want more information about this Kickstarter campaign to raise money to get this to save these tapes and to put out this documentary?
Yeah. So we're in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign to save the tapes. and to finish the production. We've done, most of the production is done. It's essentially interviews. We have a few more to go. And the bulk of this money that we're raising will go towards saving tapes, as many as we can. We've been doing it for about a week. We got 30 days to raise $15,000. We're hitting 50% as we speak. So we've had a good first week, but we're still nervous. We won't make it. So we're looking for as much support as we can get. You can go to Kickstarter.com and search on Video Freaks, and our project will come up. Video Freaks is all one word, VideoFreex. It's the Video Freaks' own copyrighted spelling of the word. Well, it's not really a word. It's their own word. So you got to remember it's EEX. You can also go to VideoFreaks.com, which is a website for the film, and there's a link right on the front of that you can go right to the Kickstarter campaign.
I think there's a Wikipedia page too somewhere.
If you search on Video Freaks in Google, you'll come up with lots of stuff.
All sorts of things, yes.
Yeah, all sorts of things. There's been books written. Perry Teasdale wrote a great book.
We should tell folks he's still the editor of the Columbia paper. Used to be the editor of the Independent in Columbia County, and was the editor of several papers on the Greene County side before that. And he was one of the members.
Yeah, he was one of the founding members of the Video Freaks. It wouldn't have happened without him. And he wrote a great book, and that will pop up when you Google Video Freaks. And that's actually one of the rewards that we're giving out as part of the campaign. It's kind of like our own PBS fundraiser. We have a bunch of rewards for different pledge levels. Basically, the way Kickstarter works is that for films or other independent artistic and design projects, the makers like us put the idea out there, and we are asking, it's almost like pre-buying things. We have rewards, and there's things like the DVD, which obviously doesn't exist yet. It will exist when we're done with the film, and you can pre-buy it. If you donate $35 to the project, you will get a DVD back. And there's other things. We have buttons. We have a tote bag. Perry's book. Another one of the Video Freaks, Nancy Kane. She also wrote a memoir. That's one of the rewards. There's a bunch of things that you can check out. And I hope people do.
And is there any hope of a reunion? Or are they have they worked together recently? Or is this just archival, this project?
No, in fact, there will be kind of a reunion happening this fall with the School of Visual Arts and the Paley Center in New York are going to do a little bit of a retrospective of Video Freaks' work, and we'll probably be a part of that, showing some pieces of the film in whatever state it is at that point. We most likely won't be done with the film, but we'll have something to show, and we'll hopefully be a part of that reunion retrospective celebration, whatever they're going to call it. And that's, I think, it's going to be at the end of October, beginning of November. So that's exciting. So it's funny, you know, here we are, however many years later, and this previously little known story is getting a little bit of a revival. It's interesting. It's exciting for us. And I hope it's exciting for all the Video Freaks. It's an inspiring story to me. I find it very inspiring. Here were this group of artists finding their own way and really forging their own path at a time when there were no precedents to what they were doing. And they weren't doing it to make money. They weren't trying to be rich. They were, you know, searching for their own art in video and providing a service to the community and just living life. And that's kind of exciting and inspiring.
Do you think the project has been influential to later generations of video artists or pirates or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think in ways that people don't even know. I think that they were part of this kind of the early video movement informed a lot of what came later. Not only Video Freaks, but some of the other groups. A lot of people worked in groups back then. The Rain Dance and some other collectives in New York and around the country. And a lot of people came together for a few projects called TV in the 70s. And that kind of freewheeling video with a real perspective, kind of first person, it's hard to really put your finger on it and put it in a nutshell. But the spirit of what they did and what other video collectives were doing lives on, and you can see it in the work of Michael Moore, and a lot of other filmmakers are informed by that work, and a lot of people are who don't even know it, like anything that has a cultural, you know, history. We don't even understand how these influences work. But when you peel the onion back and you see and you find these stories like the Video Freaks, and you see that they were kind of doing their own thing. They were there. There was nobody showing them how to use a port-a-pack. There was nobody showing them how to build a pirate television station. When you peel the history back and you find these seeds, that you realize, okay, this is where something started.
I'm Tom Rowe. You've been listening to Turn on the News, a daily look at radio news, radio art, sound art, media art, and more. A radio show about radio. Go to FREE103POINT9.org or newsroom.313.9.org for more information about just what transmission art is or why there is a radio show about radio. You've been listening to an interview with John Nealon, a filmmaker who is working on a documentary about the Video Freaks, an historic video collective from 1968 to 1979, settled in the Catskill Mountains and started the first pirate television station in Lanesville and Greene County, New York, in the early 70s. I'm Tom Rowe. You've been listening to Turn on the News through Free 103.9 and available through the Pacifica Network.
The preceding show was produced by Free 103.9 at the WGXE Studios in New York.